Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman sees it, Americans are in the middle of World War III, whether they like it or know it or not. Canceled flights, sudden bombings abroad, National Guardsmen posted at bridges and tunnels across the country. What you are witnessing is why September 11th amounts to World War III, Friedman writes, the third great totalitarian challenge to open societies in the last 100 years. It is a grim analysis, but Friedman's foreign policy critique and his proposed solutions have the White House, Middle East heads of state, and millions of readers tuning in. Tonight on Point, New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman on Israel, on Iraq, on the era he calls World War III. Thomas Friedman joins me now from Washington. He is a three-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize in 1983, from Lebanon in 1988, from Israel, and again for post-9/11 commentary in 2002. He is the author of the best-selling From Beirut to Jerusalem, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, and Longitudes and Attitudes, The World in the Age of Terrorism, a collection of his columns from September 2001 to June 2002. He recently completed a six-part series, War of Ideas, about the urgent need to tap the forces of moderation in the Arab and Muslim world to win the war on terror. Good evening and welcome to On Point, Tom Friedman.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
It's great to have you. You're a great outpost of clear-spoken views. You pack a punch. We know where you're coming from. You've been around. We've got enormous respect for your writing and have for a long time, Tom Friedman. And have, of course, along with the rest of the country and no small part of the world, followed you extremely closely since 9/11. There's so much to talk about tonight, and I want to dive in about the things we've learned this week and last from David Kaye and hearing from George Tenet and George Bush. Let me just ask you a big, broad question to begin with.
Shoot.
You've been a big supporter of engaging with Iraq and engaging through war, if necessary, to bring about a change there. Given everything we've seen and your own harsh criticism of how the post-invasion era has worked out, did you misjudge the American capacity to execute post-invasion in Iraq?
No, not in the least. Anyone who's been following me from the very beginning knows that throughout the pre-war, I actually did a series of columns or repeated over and over the theme that the real story here is day three. Mm-hmm. Day one, we invade. Day two, we oust Saddam Hussein. Day three, we own Iraq. I had a mantra before the war that the way to think about Iraq is the way to think about the sign in the pottery store. Mm-hmm. You break it, you own it. Mm-hmm. We broke it, we own it. And what I argued throughout the pre-war was that we need to have a plan, and we need to have maximum allies and maximum legitimacy for managing a reality as complex as Iraq on day three. And, you know, I should start with a disclaimer. And this is by no means an apology. I don't regret anything I've written. But that I never would have gone about this war the way these people went about it. Before they raised the subject of invading Iraq, it was not, as any reader of my column knows, something I was beating a drum for. Mm-hmm. I didn't start this war. I couldn't stop this war. My interest all along has been to try to shape it and tilt it in a way where I thought it would be able to provide the maximum benefit for us, for Iraqis, and for the future of the Middle East.
And we want to come around to that big deal.
And so that's really where I'm coming from.
Yep, we want to hear that. But I'm going to press you a little more on this.
Go ahead.
And, you know, forgive me, but you swing a big club here. And I really want to understand
your own thinking. I mean, quite right. You didn't propose the war. You didn't launch it. But you, from the sidelines, you were telling us this can be the right thing. This can be, in fact,
right.
Just
my mantra was right war, but you got to do it right.
You got to do it right. But here's the issue: you do swing a big club. I mean, if a doctor recommends surgery that the surgeon can't deliver, has the doctor made a mistake? And I don't mean to make this too personal, but
sure.
But you see what I'm saying?
Well, you ask a very pertinent question to one I ask myself.
You said we needed a plan. We needed maximum allies.
Right.
We needed legitimacy. We went into Iraq without a plan. It is now clear of any merit. Without allies, clear at the time, and legitimacy. I mean, the UN was scarcely with us.
Right.
So if it didn't meet those criterion.
Right.
Why didn't you hit the brakes?
Why didn't I oppose it then? And it's something that I it's actually an issue. I'll take you inside the world of a columnist. By accident, the war started on a Tuesday night, and in those days I was writing Wednesdays and Sundays, so I actually had to write a column for Wednesday morning. The front page headline in the New York Times was, Bush starts war. And my column happened to be running the very same day. And so I literally was in Chicago O'Hare Airport talking to my wife, and I was saying to her, well, this is it, honey. You know, I've been saying all along, right war, but you got to do it right. These guys haven't done it right.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do I say? And I really had two choices. And it really gets to the moral question you've asked, because it really is a moral question.
Yes, it is.
I could have at that point said, well, I've been saying it's the right war, but you got to do it right. And these guys haven't done it right. And so I'm out of here. I withdraw my support. That would have been a perfectly legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that was morally, for the reasons you've intimated in your question, Tom, morally irresponsible. That I felt I had come this far in understanding, appreciating, and articulating my own logic for the war. And that it was struck me as just morally corrupt to suddenly then bail out. And so I wrote a column that basically said the following.
Yeah.
I believed that this was the right war for these reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the right way to approach this war was this way. They have not done it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And henceforth, this column will be used in the effort to turn lemons into lemonade. In my own little way, in my own little white space, to try to take a war which I couldn't stop and whose underlying logic I believed in, and tilt it in my own little way, in my own little white space, hopefully in the right direction.
So
the real question is, if I could just say, do I regret doing that?
Yes.
That's what I did,
right.
If I might say.
Right.
And I don't. I would say, and you could sort of track this in my column, I've actually become an even stronger believer in this war now that I've been to Iraq three times, and now that I've seen it unfold, and also a stronger advocate for trying to do it right.
But you're also warning us very often of how badly wrong this could go. I want to circle back one more time, and forgive me,
please,
because there's a lot more we want to talk about here. But you frame it as a moral question, and I understand that context for it. But is it not also a kind of professional question and intellectual question? And this goes back to the capacity and intent. It was the Bush administration with these leaders who were going to execute this war.
Right.
So did they have the predisposition, the capacity, the intent to deliver the aftermath that you had in mind? And wasn't it incumbent upon you to probe at that and come to a conclusion about that? And if they haven't delivered, in fact, you've been at times scathingly critical of how they've actually delivered, wasn't it your responsibility in advance to us, given the stakes here, to assess their capacity and intent, even the likelihood of their world vision to deliver what you had in mind?
Well, you've done two things there, Tom. One is you've articulated my wife's position, number two, you've written what will be to me the very legitimate criticism of me today or somewhere down the road. If all this goes bad, and I'm kind of ready to live with that, because my answer to my wife, as I wrote, I had a mixed marriage. My wife was against the war for exactly those reasons. She understood why I believed it was the right war, and she appreciated and respected that. But she said, these people will never do it right.
Mm.
And
you called it the other way? You honestly believed that they would?
Or that the
payoff, if they did, was so great that it was worth the risk, the very large risk, of everything that could go wrong if they didn't deliver?
Exactly. I believe two things. The payoff was so huge, number one, if they did it right. And number two, I believed, and I still don't regret this yet, although talk to me in a month or 2 months, that once they were in it, the stakes would be so high that they would eventually have to do it right. And I still believe the book on that is out. And that's why I tilted where I tilted. And I'll tell you, when I wrote that I had a mixed marriage, I was inundated with email from readers who said, your wife is smarter than you. Please listen to your wife. And I'm glad you sleep with a woman more intelligent than you are. And so I know, I mean, I've been kind of fighting with my natural, what I would call liberal internationalist readership since this war started, since this whole issue evolved.
Yes,
clearly. I've had a very different position on it, a take on it. I think it's a coherent one. It's tied together. It's very, very clear in my head why I've come down there. But so it's been a real tug of war with my readers. The worst have really just washed their hands of me. And not the worst, the most angry have washed their hands with me. The many others have said, if you're for it for these reasons, then I'll at least look at it, you know. And so,
well, and people are looking now because they did look at it, because Tom Friedman, if Tom Friedman's for it, it gave a lot of people whose instinct might have been the other way pause.
Right. And I feel an enormous, just sort of personal, again, in my tiny little universe, great responsibility for that, which is why I'm in this position of constantly trying to support, you know, the administration when I think they're doing the right thing, and scream from the rooftops on the wrong thing.
Let me ask you, for
those two reasons, Tom, because I believe the payoff is so great, and because I believe once we're in it, we have to do it right.
You know, the dream of a beautiful payoff can be an extraordinarily powerful thing. Of course, it can also be a dangerous thing if that payoff is unrealistic,
between,
if it's beyond attaining.
There's a fine line between optimism and wishful thinking. I realize that.
Speaking of your liberal internationalist readership, and you may well have seen this, but let me just read you a couple things. This is from the Nation. Here's Eric Altman writing, and Slate's Jacob Weisberg has been writing about liberal hawks, liberals who were for the war, and they both give you the respect that you clearly deserve, but also really come after you here. And let me just read you a couple of things. They give you the credit, America's most influential foreign affairs interlocutor. But then, his oft-proclaimed optimism, a more accurate term might be ahistorical naivete, and then here's the really hard one, leads him down a road to hell in which he is effectively shilling for a group of people who have in mind exactly the opposite of what he insists needs to take place in Iraq, i.e. the Bush administration. And they go on to say, to place one's trust in the honesty and goodwill of Bush and co. is a far more grievous error than liberals made in 1964, because we have been to this movie before. Your response, Tom Friedman?
Time will tell, you know. I'm ready to take that chance because I believe the stakes are so high.
But they're speaking here about the intent of the Bush administration, which part of what your hope must ride on. They are the executing power.
Right.
Do you disagree? Are you confident that they're in the sidecar of your motorcycle here, that they're driving in the direction you would go? Do they have the same goal in mind?
I think at this stage, the only way that they can get out of this, I mean, they're on the line much more than I am, you know, in terms of the history here. The only way they can get out of this is if they produce a decent outcome in Iraq. And all I have called for all along, and let's not exaggerate, again, I've been very precise in my language, is a decent government in Iraq. I've shied away consistently from the word democracy. It may have crept in there once or twice, but I've been very careful to stress that we want a decent outcome there. And I still believe that's possible. And I believe that is the only way that the Bush administration itself will salvage its historical reputation. So in that sense, I believe our interests are aligned. But let me also say something else to the critics of this war and this and my position. The status quo is what brought us 9/11. Excuse me. We all know what the cost of doing something was. We see that playing out before our eyes. Mm-hmm. But we don't know what the cost of doing nothing was, number one. Number two, yes, this war has been a mess, you know, for the most part, in many ways in Iraq. But it's also triggered an amazing conversation in the Arab Muslim world. I just came from the office. I just printed out a story coming out of Damascus that 1,100 Syrian intellectuals have sent a petition to President Bashar Assad demanding an end to martial law. Do you think that happens without this war in Iraq? No way, okay? Do you think Muammar Gaddafi woke up one morning and had therapy and decided, you know, those nukes in the basement, I'm really uncomfortable with them? No way.
Tom, okay? Premier, we've got to take a short break. We want to dive into that Middle Eastern conversation. Okay. We're so glad to have you tonight. We're not taking calls this evening, but you can get into the conversation online at onpointradio.org. We're talking with New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Tom Friedman, New York Times foreign affairs columnist, swings a big club on affairs around the world, in the United States, in the Middle East in particular. Delighted to have him with us tonight. He's been taking some rough treatment from some corners lately, but he's...
I've been taking rough treatment since the start. Believe me, this
since
is
the start.
Nothing.
Since
this
the start.
Is nothing. You should have seen me when I was writing my book on globalization.
Yeah, if it's not one thing, it's another.
Exactly.
You said just now, Tom, that what you really hope for in Iraq is a decent outcome. Define that for us.
I would say a decent outcome is an outcome where all the Iraqi parties feel that there is a political structure in which their voices are represented enough that we can enjoy a period of stability during which real institutions, which after all are the real foundation of democracy, can be built and a real economy can get going. So you can hold elections one day in an environment where you don't have 50% unemployment, no institutions, and you raise the prospect of one man, one vote, one time. So that's what I would call a decent outcome.
So that is the prospect of democracy.
Right, exactly. I think you have to lay the foundations. It's going to require a transition, as we've seen in Russia and in Eastern Europe. You don't go from regimes like Saddam's, 35 years of a genocidal tyranny, to Jeffersonian democracy in one leap. It's not going to happen.
All right. It is the Bush administration that took the country to war there. It's the Bush administration that's been... You've been watching very closely. What have you learned? What are the limitations of this administration in delivering that decent outcome that you hope for?
What are your hopes for
this administration?
Yeah, right. I want to go back to this this previous point because I was interrupted at the break. And as I said, let's look at some of the things this war has also done. Okay. This war has triggered, as I said, I think a remarkable conversation in the Arab Muslim world, one that is in our enormous and their enormous long-term interest. As I said, we see this week a petition from 1,000 Syrian intellectuals calling for an end to martial law. We've had the Syrian president summon the editor of the New York Times to Damascus for an interview offering to resume peace negotiations with Israel, number one. We've seen at the end of the Hajj in Saudi Arabia this week, Saudi Arabia's leading Muslim cleric give a speech declaring that terrorism has no place, terrorism in any way, shape, or form in and with Islam, okay? Thirdly, we've seen Libya, as I said, Muammar Gaddafi suddenly decide he's had therapy and doesn't really want these nukes he has in his basement. Mm-hmm. I believe what's going on in Iran right now, both the fear of the conservatives and their crackdown and the demand for the first time, the fact of the liberals, the reformers in the Iranian parliament tendering their resignation, something they have not ever dared to do before, is not unrelated. Okay, to having America on their doorstep and what's been going on inside Iraq. Okay, this is just what we've seen in public. In private, I would tell you there are even more remarkable conversations. The spillout from this war will be enormous and it will be long term. Some will be negative. I think a lot will be positive in ways that are fundamentally important for their interests and ours. Number two, okay, these same liberals, okay, who would have been at the forefront of human rights abuses in places like Bosnia or Rwanda, okay, What did we do when
a little late in Rwanda, we'd say.
Okay, but what did we do when we took out Saddam? We say, let's see, we removed a guy who was responsible for the death of a million Iranians and Iraqis in the Iran-Iraq war and maiming of hundreds of thousands of others, a man who had used poison gas against the Kurds, a man who, according to Human Rights Watch, may have slaughtered about 300,000 of his own people, a man who raped Kuwait, and we're still, we have thousands of Kuwaitis still missing from that enterprise, and a man who gave Palestinians $25,000 booby prizes
for
suicide bombing against Israelis.
But we didn't do it for those reasons. We did not do it. We were not taken to war for those reasons. We were taken to war for WMD.
Yeah. Right. Of course. That is true. Unfortunately, not our support. And I made very, very clear, as you know, from my columns all before the war, that not only did I not believe there was any WMD there that threatened us, that was not the reason to go to war. The reason to go to war was to partner with the Iraqis to implement the Arab Human Development Report. WMD was never part of my argument.
Of your argument, but of course it is the one that the administration held high and clear. Let's circle around then, Tom, because you also make clear, I mean, we're reading Tom Friedman here to learn that the outcome of this great struggle in Iraq and across the Middle East is by no means assured, to quote from one T. Friedman. And the country is now looking at making a decision about how and who they want to lead this effort forward. So help us out. What is your assessment of the Bush administration's strengths and weaknesses, limitations, given what we've seen, and you've been watching closely, going forward with this war in Iraq and the vision of a kind of transformation in the Middle East? Is this the crew to do it, given the evidence?
I still really have my concerns. These are people who I think still fundamentally don't understand that we can destroy any country in the world. There's no country in the world we cannot destroy alone. And there's no country in the world we can rebuild alone, especially one as complicated as Iraq in the very heart of the Arab Muslim world. And I would say that's been the core and consistent core of my critique of this administration.
That's a pretty big critique, given all we have on our hands now, 50 for state, $160 billion and counting in dollars, 500 lives American lives alone and counting. So are you going to be making a recommendation for the vote in November?
Oh, I'm not allowed to endorse candidates.
Are you comfortable with this administration?
The New York Times, no columnist is allowed. Only the gray lady herself endorses candidates.
Are you comfortable with this administration taking forward America's foreign policy in the Middle East?
I wouldn't get into that at all. I mean, you're asking me for an endorsement in another way, and I'm not allowed to do that.
Well, you could look at
it. I'm not going to endorse questions, so don't try.
No, that's absolutely fine. But people, I mean, the people listening to this show are going to have a decision to make.
Right.
And
let's just say
we can read between your lines for months.
I think anyone reading my column could read. I hope we'll be able to make an appropriate choice in November.
What do you make at this point of the foreign policy sounds on the Middle East, on Iraq, that you've heard from Democratic nominees or candidates, I should say?
Well, I think that Kerry and Edwards and Clark, I haven't studied their positions. And, you know, when you're appealing to the Democratic primary voter, I don't expect you to have a full-throated foreign policy on Iraq necessarily laid out. But what I've heard from Kerry and Edwards, both have aligned themselves with a report put out by the Progressive Policy Institute on kind of winning the war of ideas. It was written by and with Will Marshall and other people, and it's a terrific document. I couldn't associate myself more with it. It so articulates the very reasons I supported this war, you know, which is to partner with the people in that part of the world to create a context, a different context, where governments can emerge and young people can lead their lives. And both Edwards and Kerry have associated themselves with that report, as far as I know. And so I'm pretty comfortable that they both kind of get it.
Much more to watch there as we get closer to the election.
Yeah. Tom Friedman. I mean, I don't hear either man calling for, the Kucinich position, you know, let's just get up and leave.
Get out. Mm-hmm.
In fact, what I hear both guys saying is that I voted for the war. I understood its logic, but we have to approach it in a better, smarter, and more multilateral way. Well, that's been basically what I've been arguing all along.
Is there any point at which Tom Friedman would say, oh, boy, we blew it. Let's get out of there.
Oh, yeah.
Any number of lives?
It won't be a dollar figure. It'll be if Iraq lapses into civil war. And it's clear that our presence there is making it worse, not better, and that it's impossible to build that decent ways from that yet.
What's your optimism? You're famously optimistic. What's your optimism meter reading right now? What are the odds of the U.S. pulling off the decent outcome that you desire?
Yeah, I don't want to put odds on it, but all I know is right now I don't see a plan yet for producing the kind of political framework we need, either via elections or caucuses or an expansion of the governing council, in order to get us, you know, to that decent Iraq. That's what's in play right now. That's what Kofi Annan is wrestling with. It's what Bremer
right
is wrestling
now.
With.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to, you know, if that doesn't happen, well, that leads down one scenario. If it does happen, that leads to a different scenario, and we're swimming in the middle of that river.
What are you hearing? You've said you'd like to see an Afghanistan-style compromise, where where we expand from a couple of dozen to 75 or 100, the kind of controlling Iraqi group there. And you describe. What would you like to see?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that seems like a decent a compromise between Sistani's demand for elections now, which I worry could be incredibly messy and violent, and Bremer's proposal for kind of Iowa caucuses Iraq style, which seems to me hopelessly complicated. And so, again, I proposed a kind of Afghan Loya Jirga model where the governing council is expanded. They then elect an interim government amongst themselves. Mm. And because the majority would be Shia, that the interim president no doubt would be Shiite. And then we have a kind of transition government for maybe a year or two,
right,
where you can get that kind of stability, get the economy going, and create a much better framework for an electoral process.
Tom Friedman, let's step back, if we may, to your big war of ideas. You had a 5-6-7-part series recently in the New York Times op-ed page of your columns. A war of ideas that's global, but it's most importantly within the Arab world. You describe a scene where you were standing at Google's headquarters in Silicon Valley not so long ago, looking at a big map of the world, and in a way, it spoke to your fundamental concern and critique here. Take us there.
Well, Google has a globe in its offices that emits light in percentage. Somehow they've, you know, erected
wired it up
of people searching on Google. You know, so you can literally see. I mean, like the United States is all lit up, and you know, Western Europe's all lit up, and Japan's lit up, and lots of coastal China's lit up. But the Arab world, I mean, from Morocco, I mean, the Arab Muslim world from Morocco to the border of India does not emit a lot of light. Not a lot of people there online, and not a lot of people are searching for knowledge.
And you take this as a kind of metaphor or example of the problem. What is the problem?
Well, the problem was really diagnosed in the Arab Human Development Reports. These reports were produced over the last 3 years by United Nations Development Program, UNDP, in cooperation with 30, 40 very courageous Arab intellectuals and social scientists who asked themselves post 9/11 some really profound questions. How is it that the Arab world, the 22 states of the Arab world, don't have the combined GDP of Spain? How is it that almost half the adult women in the Arab world are still illiterate? How is it that 25% of all Arab college grads want to leave the region? How is it that Greece last year translated 5 times more books from English to Greek than the entire Arab world combined translated from English to Arabic? How is it that between the year 1980 and 2000, the Arab world, the 9 leading Arab economies, filed 370 patents for new inventions in the United States? And in that same 20-year period, 1980 to 2000, South Korea filed 16,832.
Pretty remarkable numbers.
Okay, those are really stark numbers. And I'd like to ask some of my liberal, unoptimistic friends, what do they think are the implications of those numbers? If we just let it go, if we
walk
just
away.
Do nothing, just walk away. Come on, you can't trust these Bush guys. You, Friedman, you're a naive optimist. But I'll tell you something, boys and girls, okay? Those numbers, Those numbers are the context that produced 9/11. Now, I may be an optimist, but I'm no naive fool. I know this part of the world. I am a strategic optimist, okay? Because if my optimism, okay, doesn't come through, if you don't believe in it, then I got some real simple advice for you, Tom, okay? And it's as follows. Stick your head between your legs and kiss your behind goodbye.
Well, thank you, Tom Freeman.
All right? Because we are talking about some trend lines that in a world without walls are really, really dangerous. And, I supported this war in some ways at the end on a wing and a prayer.
Yeah.
But the wing and the prayer is to hopefully partner with people in that part of the world to begin to tilt it in another direction. Because if you don't visit a bad neighborhood in this world, it will visit you. And on 9/11, it visited us. And this war, or this the political outcome of this war, I should say, for me, is the antidote to those forces which produced 9/11. That's been the logic I've been arguing in favor of. That's been what I've been trying to tilt the administration on. And all these, you know, liberals, you know, who are so tough and so savvy, much smarter than me, they aren't naive like me, you know.
Certainly not.
Well, give me a break, okay? There was nothing you know, naive about 9/11.
So there's no choice but getting in there.
Right. There's no choice, okay? You got to do something. Is this team doing it the right way? No, they haven't been in many ways. But this is the horse I've got to ride. This is the moment I'm living in, and I'm going to try to tilt it in the right direction. I am going to go down swinging.
Tom Freeman, what is the alignment of forces inside that sphere, then, the kind of balance of power or array of power between the moderates that you describe and the Islamists, which you describe as not even agreeing on the bedrock rules of civilization with the West, with the United States?
What is the array of forces? It's hard to generalize. Mm-hmm. You know, in Jordan, for instance, you have a really progressive monarch now, who is really taking a lot, King Abdullah, who's taking a lot of the analysis of the Arab Human Development Report. And again, what was the conclusion of the Arab Human Development Report? All of these problems, it said, are a result of three deficits: a deficit of freedom, a deficit of modern education, and a deficit of women's empowerment. And again, what did I say before the war? Mm-hmm. That should be our flag. We should be going to Iraq under the banner of the Arab Human Development.
But the moderates who might be our allies in that, how strong are they? How would you characterize that? Who's on top here?
We see it's very hard. You see, you're asking me, you know, when you're dealing with 22 illiberal societies,
yes,
you know, it's very hard to answer that question, all right?
And then they get lumped together as a problem.
Right. I mean, they're all part of the same problem. But Morocco and Jordan, for instance, have two really progressive monarchs who are working in their own way. And this is a gradual process. And again, being fair to my own analysis, I supported this war for my great-grandchildren. We're dealing with a part of the world that has been on vacation from history for 800 years, okay? And vacation's over. And you and I are going to live through the unstable transition as they move out of this blind alley they've been, hopefully into something better. But it's going to be rocky and unstable. Hopefully, my great-grandchildren will benefit from them doing it. One thing I know for sure, If nothing changes, given that, you know, there's a demographic explosion happening from Morocco to the border of India, too. And if nothing changes, if nothing's done, all right, we are dealing with enormously potent, unstable forces here. And they will come to haunt us.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking with New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Freeman. For more on Tom Freeman and his writing, go to our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this program comes from O.S. Friedman,
three-time Pulitzer Prize winner, a man who moves minds and maybe even armies globally. I want to move to an area where the United States has leverage. The leverage of the U.S. in different points of this map that you're drawing here is obviously different in different places. Israel, one would think there's leverage, and so the responsibility is great. You've written a lot about it. Just this week, we have Ariel Sharon coming out saying, okay, let's get the Israeli settlements out of Gaza Strip. At the same time, you've written quite recently that the U.S. policy toward Israel in the Middle East right now fits your definition of insane. Why?
Well, it's a good way to transition from Iraq, Tom. What are we doing in Iraq? What are we attempting to do in Iraq is what I would call implement the strategy of Yitzhak Rabin when he was forging the Oslo peace process. What was Rabin's strategy? He said, we will fight the terrorists as if there's no peace process. And we will build a peace process as if there's no terrorism. Because ultimately, the long-term antidote to terrorism is to build the weight and institutions of a two-state solution. That's, to me, the right strategy. What are we doing in Iraq? We're doing just that. The Bush administration has adopted the strategy of Rabin. We'll fight the insurgents as if there's no nation building, and we will nation build and try to produce an electoral process and a decent political framework as if there's no insurgency.
And in
I think
Israel?
That's the right. And in Israel, the Bush administration has aligned itself with exactly the opposite strategy. The strategy of Sharon was to say, we are going to fight the terrorists as if there's no peace process, period, until the last terrorist says uncle, which is another way of empowering the last idiot terrorist, okay? And we have aligned ourselves with that strategy. In other words, in Israel and Iraq, we have aligned ourselves with completely opposite strategies, all right?
Why?
In the theater that's under our control, we're practicing the strategy of Rabin, and in the theater that's under Sharon's control, we are practicing the strategy of Sharon.
Why?
It's because of domestic politics. That's why. It's a combination of things. First of all, they came into office with sort of anti-Clintonism disease.
Whatever they did, we won't do.
If Clinton thought it was important, by definition, it must be unimportant. So that was their general attitude to this. And then if Clinton had an idea, the Clinton plan, can't do that. Have to come up with our own plan. You know. And thirdly, this is an administration that has a lot of support among the Christian evangelical community that believes very strongly in Israel and not in a two-state solution because they believe that the ingathering of the Jews will be the necessary first stepping stone to the return of the Messiah.
Right, second coming.
And traditional, you know, conservative Jewish lobbyists and organizations that tend to not want the U.S. government to put any pressure on Israel when it does the right thing or it does the wrong thing. You put it all together, and you have a policy that's brought us to where we are today, where Sharon says, okay, I think I'll withdraw from Gaza. Great, I'm all for it, you know.
But where's he headed with that?
Meanwhile, he's decimated Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority without building an alternative moderate Palestinian structure. Therefore, he's left a vacuum in which Hamas and Hezbollah have moved in. And so, great, now he's talking about pulling out, and we could end up with the Islamic Republic of Palestine.
If that doesn't change, and Sharon, as you say, as you see it, I guess, is not looking for a two-state solution, but something quite different, where are we headed here?
I think Israel, the Jewish state, is in serious danger for the long term, because I think that given the demographic trends, within a decade or somewhere close to it, there will be more Palestinians than Jews living between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. And therefore, if Israel doesn't get out of these territories in a stable and sustainable way, Israel will be faced with two very stark choices. One is to give Palestinians a vote, in which case there won't be a Jewish state. Or the other is to have a Jewish minority ruling over a Palestinian majority. And that has a name. It's called apartheid.
That sounds like trouble. So there's Israel's problem, in your view, Tom Friedman, if it goes down this path. What about U.S. and Israeli interests, I guess, as you'd interpret them, in this broader issue of the conversation, the battle of ideas in the Middle East, if this isn't resolved? What's the impact?
Well, you know, let me just say, I lived on a kibbutz in Israel all three summers of high school. I did my sophomore year at the Hebrew University. I'm a big believer in the Jewish state and the right of the Jewish people to have a state. And I'm also a big believer that that state will only be safe and secure, and they'll only be able to take our shoes off in that state if there's a Palestinian state next door. where Palestinians can do the same. I believe that since I believed anything.
And if there's not, what are the implications for the huge world interest, U.S. interest, and ultimately, as you'd see, Israeli interests, if that doesn't happen?
Well, I think what you're going to see is three forces converge around Israel, Tom, and they're already gathering. One is this huge population explosion, which I talked about, you know, 40% of Saudi Arabia under the age of 15, mm-hmm. 75% under the age of 30. That's true in all these countries.
Rampant unemployment.
So you have an incredible demographic bubble, you know, from Morocco, as they say, to the border of India. You have a population explosion happening on that track. On the second track, you have an explosion of the worst interpersonal violence between Israelis and Palestinians we've seen since the start of this conflict. Mm-hmm. And on a third track, you're seeing an explosion of Arab multimedia, Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, you know, all of these new satellite stations that have emerged, and the internet, and you know, newspapers published in Europe in Arabic. And basically, what's happening around Israel, Tom, is that this multimedia explosion is taking the images of this violent explosion and feeding them to this population explosion. And it is radicalizing them and Arabizing them and raising them with the view that the threat to their future is something I would call JIA, Jews, Israel, and America. It's all being wrapped together in one omnibus ball. And I believe that that is a threat to Israel. I believe it's a threat to American interests. I think it's a tragedy for the future of the Arab Muslim world. And that's why I've said in that article, I've said all along until I'm breathless, Israel needs to draw a line with the Palestinians. I don't know where the line should be exactly. I live in Washington, D.C., but I do know there needs to be a line. And I believe American policy should be to wake up every morning and say, what have we done today to cajole, force, encourage Israelis and Palestinians to draw a stable and sustainable line between them, because that's in their best interest and ours. And my criticism of this administration is that's not how they have woken up every morning.
Is this administration capable, given the array of forces that they're responding to, is it capable of doing that?
Probably not. I don't want to say categorically, but I'd say probably not.
Tom Friedman, it's a great pleasure talking with you. And for all the rough time we give you, we really appreciate the kind of open and honest searching you do in your columns. It's just terrific. We're grateful for it. And we thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, I appreciate very much. It was an intelligent interview. And as I say, pessimists are usually right, somebody told me the other day, quoting somebody I don't know. And optimists are usually wrong. But all the positive change in history has been done by optimists.
Go, Tom, go. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks.
Tom Friedman, New York Times foreign affairs columnist. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a 40-year look back at the Beatles' invasion of America. This is On Point. Forty years ago tomorrow, four mop-topped British musicians disembarked a plane at New York's Kennedy Airport and changed the course of history. During their two-week stay in the United States, the Beatles took the country by storm, performing to sold-out crowds in three cities and appearing on the most-watched TV program that television had ever seen. Martin Goldsmith is former host of NPR's Performance Today and the author of the new book, The Beatles Come to America. In this radio diary, he takes us back 40 years ago to the Beatles' two-week trip that he says helped set the stage for the tumult of the 1960s.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you tomorrow.
I really think that the Beatles performed a certain service to this country without knowing it. Just 76 days before the Beatles played Ed Sullivan for the first time, the country had buried its young president, John Kennedy, who had been assassinated in Dallas. And I think that one of the reasons that we clasped the Beatles so close to us was the fact that we were just very, very slowly coming out of our gloom and depression that the assassination had caused. I think John Kennedy appeared to us to be youthful and witty and vibrant, And suddenly there were among us these four young Englishmen who were obviously youthful and witty and brought with them this very, very vibrant music. And I think that was one of the reasons that we fell so madly in love with the Beatles 40 years ago. She loves you, yeah. Arrived on Friday, February 7th, 1964, at Kennedy Airport in New York City to a tumultuous reception. The next day's New York Times quoted an airport official saying that we've never seen anything like this at Kennedy Airport, not even for kings or queens, not for Khrushchev, not for Fidel Castro when he came. This is the biggest event in the history of the airport. Then the Beatles were ushered into the arrivals hall at Pan Am Airways, where they gave their famous press conference, where they parried some of the not always friendly questions from the assembled New York press.
Can you please sing something?
No! Sorry.
Next question!
No, we need money first.
There's a question here.
How many a ball if you have to wear those bits?
To all of us.
I'm bald.
You're bald?
Oh, we're all bald.
Don't
yeah.
tell anyone, please.
I'm deaf and dumb, too.
This is deaf and married.
We're only a
dad. Please.
Quiet, please.
This is a man.
Go on. All right, quiet.
Are you for real?
For real.
Come and have a feel.
Listen, I got a question. Do you
want
to get a haircut at all?
No.
Nope. No.
No, thanks.
I had one yesterday.
They appeared for the first time on Ed Sullivan's show on Sunday night, February 9th. It was reported the next day that that appearance on Ed Sullivan was watched by more people than any television program had ever achieved in the history of the medium. 73.9 million people were tuned in to see Ed Sullivan on that Sunday night.
The city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them.
When you go back and you read what the newspapers were saying about the arrival of the Beatles, and particularly how they reviewed the Beatles' first appearances, it's really amazing to see just how condescending the American press was. The Washington Post wrote about the Beatles' appearance on Ed Sullivan. They were, the Post said, the Beatles were imported hillbillies who looked like sheepdogs and sound like alley cats in agony. The Washington Star wrote an editorial saying, they bug us, and proudly stating that while America has never produced a Shakespeare, at least we can say we've never produced the Beatles either. And it struck me that the same establishment figures who were telling us that the Beatles were no good, or, you know, they were wailing weirdies, in the words of the Miami Herald, within a very few years would be telling us of the importance of going off to a place on the other side of the world called Vietnam, where we were supposed to risk our lives. It was very telling that in that same week of 1964, February 64, when the New York Times was reporting on the arrival of the Beatles, they also reported that Secretary of State Dean Rusk declared that there was no need, in his opinion, for Americans to be involved in the struggle in South Vietnam. It seemed to me that a lot of people in authority did get two of the most important calls of the 60s wrong, the Beatles and Vietnam. Looking back, I can understand why so many of us back then thought it wasn't a good idea to trust anybody over 30. The Beatles' music is timeless. It's why we are celebrating their arrival 40 years later, and it's why I'm convinced that 140 years from now and 240 years from now, we will still be loving the Beatles.
Martin Goldsmith is former host of NPR's Performance Today. His new book is The Beatles Come to America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for over 10 years.